This is the second iteration of this year of the thing, and I'm probably going to give it again next Sabbath afternoon. So we covered the catchy titles for it last night. In Sabbath Street, I called it Why Cupid is Blind. So you have to begin by knowing that Cupid is blind. So if you look at Wikipedia, it will tell you that Cupid is blind because love is blind. And what people should understand that is that love overlooks the flaws in the beloved. Now the version of the Cupid being blind that I learned, however, when I was much younger from some mythology collection, as best they can reconstruct it. Because I just remember that that was a natural outgrowth of the myth, and I haven't found the version of the myth that I was taught, but here's how I would reconstruct it. There is a myth of Eros and Psyche. Cupid is Eros. And Psyche is the most beautiful of mortal women, and therefore Venus is jealous. So Venus sends Cupid to shoot an arrow at Psyche and make her fall in love with the ugliest of beasts. So that, right, because Venus does not want Psyche to get any benefit from her beauty. But Cupid instead falls in love. Whereas Cupid instead falls in love with Psyche. And then some kind of machination occurs. Cupid tells Psyche that she's never allowed to look at him because if she looks at him, she's actually in love with the god and not with the beast. But somehow, as part of Venus's revenge, Cupid is blinded. So the shot in that version of the myth seems to be that love is blind not because it overlooks flaws, that love is blind because it's as a punishment for perceiving beauty in something other than the divine. That love, right, or in a sense, right, Eros is punished by being unable to look at a Gothic. And that's because he cared about mortal love, then he was incapable of ever appreciating Venus's beauty, which is divine love again. Okay, that would be the child of the myth. Now, I am assuming, I don't know for sure, that the author of this study, whoever it may be, is aware of this. What we have here is a myth which is kind of almost perhaps a satire, but certainly, an alternate origin about why Eros is blind. Okay, now that's usually what the Sergei is quoted to explain. It's very usually about Eros. Now I'm going to argue that Eros is actually not essential. It's actually not the essential part of this story at all. You should be aware that's the fun background. This is the whole issue in general, but how much cultural background you have to know, both in Tanakh, right, where now I think it's pretty extended non-Orthodox too, that you can't understand large sections of Tanakh without understanding the ancient Near Eastern mythological background. It's just whole things become much clearer. When you know that, to me, the easiest example of this is why you only get swallowed by a fish. Right? It's just a cultural background. You don't know why you only get swallowed by a fish? Any idea? Okay, what does Nimbe mean? Nimbe is Nimbe Nun. And Nun is a fish. And the Canadian form symbol for the city of Nimbe is a fish. So you're going to run away from the big fish. And you get swallowed by a fish. You have to know that the point of it is that the symbol of Nimbe is a fish. And it looks like you're going to make a lot of sense. There are also other places where it's not just makes a lot more sense in the Near Eastern background. That's just a fun example. So the question is, how much the cultural background you have to know in order to know about it. So I think there are probably lots of places, and certainly Professor Elman is arguing, over and over again, that you can't understand things without knowing the Zoroastrian background. I don't know it. That is an easy example of something I blew when I first gave this to Harvard Hill, is there's a wonderful Gattata about the two Miriams, which is a sort of accounting Gattata in which the assistant Malchamavis kills the wrong person. Right? The Malchamavis tells the assistant Malchamavis, go get me Maria and the Gadla, and he goes and brings the wrong Maria and the Gadla, he brings Maria and the Gadla, Sarah, they get Maria and the Gadla Dardiki, Maria and the daycare worker, when he should have brought Maria and the Gadla Sarah, Maria and the hairdresser. So the Hitman says, what do I do now? Right? And he's told, and I told him, you need to feel the right? So, right, so now that she's dead, right, so we had our quota. Right? And so Miriam Magazasara goes, right, Miriam Magazasara continues on and looks. Okay, Purim, this is part of my satire about the women and Miriam. Is that Mary, not Megadla, of course, is Mary Magdalene. And well, this is a story which claims that the birth of Jesus is an accident. Like, it was working with the story that Mary Magdalene is the same as Mary the mother. Right? And there's a story about Mary Magdalene giving her combs and her hair shampoo. Right, so that's right. That story only makes sense if you know that it gives you a pseudo Christian background. That's why it's fun. Right? That's why it's fun that it's Mary Magdalene, I think. So here too, I think that to really understand where Magdalene comes from, you have to know that Cupid is blind, and he gives you a totally right. He gives you a totally different origin of the explanation of love being blind. Now, what does Magdalene do? So they said, "Kupa kol gadol el kayam." So they cried out in a great voice to their God. This is in the Chemia, and the thing to understand this background: this is in the Chemia after all the tshuva. Like, is it after Ezra has gotten up and read the Sefer Torah and everybody's torn their garments and that, right? And first everybody goes and celebrates Sukkot, and then they go and tear their garments. After all the tshuva, they get up and they cry in a great voice. So what's wrong? So. My Amor, what does this mean? So Amor Rabbi came to the Yochanan, they said, oh, hey, and bye-bye. Haidu haidach rabba l'mikdash, that is the same thing which destroyed the first place of Mikdash, the Kalei v'Hechalei burnt the temple, the Kasidim l'kula tzadiki, and killed all the righteous, the Aguinu l'Yisrael me'arahun, and they sent all of Israel into exile, the Adayin r'ashed b'nan, and it's still dancing among us. Did you give it to us any reason other than for us to be able to receive schar for resisting it? We don't need it, and I don't need this schar, right? That's a common rabbinic phrase, right? I don't want to, like, but Yisurin should be right, Yisurin, right? Yisurin should, like, right? God punishes you, so you'll get rewards for experiencing for suffering. The response is, I don't want, let you spare me the suffering, and I'll live without the reward. Okay, in context, it's, right, we have no way of knowing as of now, what it is that we're talking about. It seems pretty clear we find out later in the Sogya, Rashi tells you now, that we're dealing with the Yetzer Hara for Avodah. If this were Tanakh, and we are disciples of Meir Sternberg, we would ask the question, why is it that we don't find out until later in the story that it's the Yetzer Hara for Avodah? I tend to think just that we're coming in the middle, although we don't have any full version of the story, and we're really supposed to know it all along, and we just have a truncated text. So I don't get any significance. I don't think Rashi is killing the story by telling you up front, this is the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah.
Do we have this parallel anywhere?
We have parallel to Ezra, we have a parallel under the Shishin, but it's also a fragment in the same way. It starts as an exegesis of this verse in each case, and so we don't know, right? This is a much broader question of the extent to which narratives found in Midrashim were originally composed as exegesis on the Sukkim, or whether what happened was, as you have in Midrash Halakha, was that there was a body of Jewish narratives which later were organized as commentaries on Midrashim. I think there's a lot to say for both cases. In this case, it seems clear to me that there must be a longer narrative about the time around the building of the Beit Hamikdash, and we have part of it. There must be extended, but can't prove it. Okay, at this point, Nafal Bukitka Mirikia, right, some kind of piece of paper, whatever it is, falls from heaven, down the Katavdo Emet, on which the word Emet is written. Now, I don't really know what Emet has to do with anything here. The idea that Emet falls from heaven to earth shows up in other nutrition. Yes, Nato.
Could it just be sometimes
with the part of MS instead of the Could be, right? As Rashi says, MS means what you just said is true. Right? The other spot, we have this other thing that's coming along and saying, Shema Minach, that's a Moshe Lepesh Baruch Hu Emes. Right? Emes is the seal of God. Which seems like kind of an overwrought conclusion based on the, you know, if all the things remain. So, whoever quoted Rav Chanina here doesn't seem, right? I think Rav Chanina is really native, and right? It's Shema Minach. From this story, then it's hard to imagine that's all it is. Yes.
Is this referring to the Midrash where they like throw Emes out to the ground and then bow out the world?
Well, that's what I was referring to. I don't think the story is. That medrash is on the pasuk emet derek tismach, right? Emet right, you know, emet shalom nashkul, right? There's a whole something in Dillon which generates this. I think you read the story. It certainly has a mind to some degree. How much I read, how much I don't know. I don't know why emet is so important here. But actually, reads it the way Michael did, which seems to make it not so significant. That doesn't explain. Right, where we get the, you know, why is this such an important thing that Shalom Echot to Moshe Lepesh Baruch Hu Emet? I'm not going to be able to answer that. I don't have any really good answer as to why Echot to Moshe Lepesh Baruch Hu Emet matters here, what truth has to do with anything. Okay. So, Osivu, Tanisa, Tilsa Yami, the Tilsa Lubasa. So they fast, so is it 3 days? Three days and three nights. And so they give it over into their hands. Nafak Asa Kiguria Dinura Dibes Kashik Rashim. So a young lion, or a fighter, comes out of the Kodesh Kashim. And Amaru Navid Yisrael, unnamed Navid, says to the Jews, Hanu Yisra de Vodazara, that thing is the Yisrael of Vodazara. Again, why we find this out now, I don't know. And then we quote an otherwise incomprehensible Pasuk in Zechariah to prove this. Okay, again, I'm not going to be able to explain what that means. When they grabbed it, Nishtamit Benitim Amzaya, so a hair fell off it, Ramatala, and it screamed, Nazal Kale Abed Meir Parsi, and its voice went 400 Parsi. There are other analyses in which 400 Parsi Odis is a magic number. It seems, you know, a really magic large number. I mean, you could have jumped 400 parsel at some point. Other thing, but again, I don't know. I have no idea other than that it was a really loud voice, and I don't know why your hair fell out. All these are things that I encourage you to figure out, to solve at some point. I do tend to think that many agadas are written in code, and every element of them has a specific meaning. Some players do it. The agadas where I figured this out is this really cool agadas in which Rava has a dialogue with the Bar Sheshach, which begins with Bar Sheshach sitting in a pool of rose petals surrounded by prostitutes. And so Rava walks in on him, and Bar Sheshach says to him, "Do you have anything like these in your heaven?" And Rava says, "Yes, ours are prettier than yours." Right, that's why my title was, but I gave this Harvard next year was our worries are buried, are bigger than yours. That the worries are, right, worries are the eternal versions that you get in the Quran. So Bar Sheshach says to him, how could they possibly be prettier? Like, what could be prettier than these? And he says, because in our Olam Haba, we have no pressure, we have no Malchut. And Bar Sheshach says, I have no Malchut either, and even the next teacher comes from the king and summons him. Okay, what is this about? So Bar Sheshach is Akdash for Babel. Which is why probably the previous guy says, my brother sends Bar Sheshach a korban on his Yom Eid. And when they challenged him, they said, Kimlo Babu is the less bread. They said he's not going to offer to Vodazara. That's really not a statement of the story of Rav and Bar Sheshach. It's a story of Babylonian culture. It's a claim that it'll be a Vodazara in the negative, and it's really not really a Vodazara. The element I was saying being there. Probably. But, so the point of that story is, I think, is an instantiation of Shmuel's position אין בין העולם הזה לימת המשיח, אלא שזה מלכי אותו בעד. Right, what true Olam Haba is only the absence of Shiva Mafia. Right, and it turns out that you can find another Gata which really pedal stand for something specific that plays it out. I think there is a fellow in Malay Dinim of name, I forget, one of the Rosh Hashiva Malay Dinim, who has a series of readings. Not Robert Bellis, no. One of the native-born Israelis who has a series of articles which I don't always agree with all of them, but I think in principle he's right about you have to read a guy that way. I remember he has a meeting of the Ashmedai stories. The Ashmedai stories are all exactly parallel. They're a parish on a particular episode of Shlomo's career. And it's Ashmedai is Shlomo. And it's just, you know, the Shlomo in the mirror universe, you know. Recreation of the Evil King Solomon, episode 16 of I think that there must be something here. I just, you know, or it may be, again, that there's some kind of cultural background, or secular cultural background, like to understand the last line, you have to both know Star Trek and a particular Star Night Live episode, in which William Shatner makes fun of other people in Greg's who are kind of like too into Trekkies, and having yelled at William Shatner shows up at a Star Trek convention and yells at the audience because they're geeks and they're not ready to get a life. And the promoter comes over to him and shows him the contract, and so he has to get up and explain that I didn't really mean that. I was just a recreation of the evil Captain Kirk of an episode of which Captain Kirk was the mirror universe, right? So, if for some reason I end up showing the collection of forbidden humor of the 21st century, 100 years from now, right, you're just not going to get it. So that happens. They say, Hechi Navid, what should we do now? Maybe God forbid this one scream is going to undo, I suspect there's got to be something, this one scream is going to undo our 3 days of fasting. And it's going to go free again. So at this point, the Navi tells them to stick it in a sealed lid barrel, and that will drown out its voice. Again, I'm sure that there's a relationship between lid and voice, and this is not just an exegesis about the soup, but there's a cultural valence to every one of these terms. I don't know. So we're just going to have to bracket that. So it works, right? It works, and they have captured the Atara from the Zara and sealed it in a lead barrel so it can't scream, and the Atara from the Zara is gone. Amru, ho, v'ipratzonu, nibai rach me yitra davira. Well, so, since it is now an ipratzon, because they gave us this Atara, nibai rach me yitra davira, let's pray to get rid of the Atara for Avera as well. And here I think we have to assume the Atara for Avera means the sexual impulse. Right, it means eros. So they pray, and this one also is given to the hands. Amar Lulu, so somebody says to them, literally it seems most likely to be the Navi, although here no Tafuk is cited. Chazuzi, Kabizu, Kabu Amar, so be careful, because if you kill this one, the world stops. The world ends, which is a bad thing. Right, you should be aware that the world ending is always a bad thing. The world ending can be a good thing. Shiach comes. But probably the world ending is a bad thing right now. And apparently they don't have the option of just sealing it up in a lead barrel. Right, it's killed or nothing. So Chashut plus the Yomit, so they imprison it for 3 days. They can't find, and this is the most famous line of this, they search for an egg, a day-old egg in all of Israel, and they don't find one. This, I think, is plausibly usually understood, although Rashi had a little more fun trying to narrow it down, as meaning that all reproduction stops, right? You don't have reproduction in the absence of the sexual impulse, and probably, that's defined as Kali Alma, it probably just means that the world comes to an end, because the world doesn't go on by its own, the world has to be regenerated. Right? Maybe it's a metaphor that all creativity stops. Right? Even chickens stop laying eggs, it's not just humanity. you know, you're really the whole world, and the whole world comes to a stop. So they say, hey, Kanami, what are we going to do now? Knock the way, Kali Alma, if we kill us, the world ends. The employer asked me, Atalga, right, if he asks for a half-mercy, and what that means, I don't know. And I have to kill it. Talga birukia lo yabe. God doesn't answer half prayers. I don't know what that means either. The only thing analogy I have is the story of Kohen Magil, in which you can't ask for rain by halves. Either you get drowned or you get. I don't know what goes on in that either.
Rashi has a bit of a solution there.
Yeah.
Because that so that you still have
any yitzhar
for
without
spouse
and
offering
one. Yeah, that would be ideal. Right. That would be ideal. Right. That would be the impact of what half means. I don't know what it means that God doesn't give you halves.
Oh.
Right? Does that mean I can only pray to become fabulous and bulky? I can't pray for us? Okay. Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Or does it mean that there are logical consequences that come with everything? I mean, you couldn't have the yeter you couldn't have the yeter exist without also having a lozar exist.
Maybe. We'll come to that. It's just, why God doesn't do it, I don't know, because it happens. I do claim it's logically entailed, but in fact, they end up getting half. Right? So it's just that God won't give it to them. So that's what I guess it comes probably. So the end of doing is that they blind it. They put some kind of destructive material in its eyes. Some kind of makeup which is destructive that actually gets in your eyes. The shafku, and they let it go free. The honey, and the effect of that was that the love will nigri be the ish decrease, gets rid of the Yitzhar offenses. Okay, so that's what love is blind means in Talmudic tradition, is that there's no Yitzhar offenses. Right, it means that it is possible, it means that in your family environment, you can have desexualized space. How that results in the Torah being blind, I don't know. I mean, it seems what it means is that there are situations in which you don't look through a sexual lens, right? That's what it does. Situations where that type of seeing is cut off. But I don't really understand the metaphor. So I think that's what the outcome is. Yes, Patricia.
Well, I think there's also a flip side of that, is that
Okay. That says you can't, right? But they are blind all the time. Right? So what is blindness? It's not selectively blind in the metaphor. The metaphor is always blind. Right? So I just don't get how that blindness manages to eliminate conceptual love that preserves adulterous love. I don't know how that works. And I'm missing a stage in the argument. Okay. So we could talk in other contexts about the value of desexualized space. Which is usually how I have the combination of homosexuality. The social cost of homosexuality, but it's not treasure right now. What is the guy that's usually used to get to argue for is the Jewish principle of sublimation as opposed to repression. That we learn is that the Yitzhara for Arayos, right, has a positive purpose, right, because if you don't have the Yitzhara for Arayos, you don't have the Yitzhara for Arayos either, and so therefore every Yitzhara must have some kind of positive purpose, and therefore Judaism doesn't believe that there is an evil impulse, which really just means that, you know, that if every impulse has a positive purpose, then you connect with the idea that people who are born with a sign of Mars should become butchers, like a natural tendency to violence, who have the violent humor, right? What is the violent humor, whatever it may be, now that I got it by itself doesn't necessarily mean that everything has to have a positive outlet. It means that it may be just that there has to be some way of preventing it. There has to be some kind of outlet for it, which is not negative. And here's the stronger claim that everything has to have a purpose. Even the Yitzhara has to have a purpose, and the understanding that the Yitzhara actually refers to the Yitzhara. Okay, that's not an implausible meaning of the Gaita. But the thing that really interests me is, the implications of that within the Agartha. The implications of that within the Agartha is, A, that there must also be a positive purpose to be Zahara for Buddhadara, and B, that positive purpose is one they were willing to live without, as opposed to the positive purpose of the Zahara for Arayas. And the Zahara for Arayas, if right, they destroyed, they can't deal with the consequences of destroying it, and so they contain it a little bit, where the Atara for Vodazara, they really do get rid of. And in large measure, this is an accurate cultural description, right? And Vaya Chaini just simply doesn't have the same Atara for Vodazara as Vaya Rishon. And you can make the claim, right, that in Vaya Stavtani, you get the Vaya Chaini, a real taking is in the bit. Right, yes? Okay, you can say that. You can say it, that it's the only thing that I know for it, that is different than the Atara for Vodazara. Okay, so that's front, yes. They don't kill the Atara for Vodazara either, they just lock it.
It's still around, it just happens to be in a bear of lead.
Yeah. So maybe they couldn't kill it either if they killed it, but it's just more easily contained. Yeah, I don't know. Again, the absence of the context to the metaphor is limiting.
Yeah,
so
unless they use
a
heart for
an
old lead barrel.
Why do you say lead barrel? Because lead drowns out sound. But why does lead take away the voice? I don't know about it. Again, there's just too many things missing. I can't be sure. Mike, any other questions? The Fume, I think, is the dude. I feel the dude with lid.
But from that point, you might be able to argue that the metaphor here is for strength.
Could be.
What would they
fit in
the
role
to begin with?
Yeah, but that doesn't matter to me. I think it's more likely a trap that you say. There must be some cultural context for lead for boxes, that's what it seems to me. And I just don't know what it is. Okay. So what is this? So I'm going to argue it against just because reading the book. I can't demonstrate it. You can decide on the end of the stuff in the false premise. I think we do get a clue as to what the cost of the Atara for Vodazara is, which is that when you capture the Atara for Vodazara, a lion of fire comes out of the Kodesh Kodeshim. Yes, Michael?
In the Atara for Vodazara,
yeah, I just think it means something that looks like a lion. That's I can't tell that not my answer. So, why did it come out of the Kodesh Kodeshim? Yes, Kodesh.
Absolutely. And that's why maybe again you can't kill it. You can't get rid of the
insult for
service, you just have to put it
into
that
box. Okay, good. So that is his background, that, right, that in Yuma Kapalas and Bet, right, you know, that one of the differences between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni is that in Bayit Rishon, the Eshel Maracha was Rehut Zakari. Okay, so I think that what it means is that all the differences between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni were the result of a conscious choice. And it's not that we couldn't have Bayit Rishon be as miraculous as Bayit Sheni, it's that we made a decision, because what they said was that Bayit Rishon was destroyed. They thought in Golos that they were better people than the people whom Bayit Rishon was. Bayit Rishon was destroyed because of Vodazara. And they thought, well, you know, guess what? We went into exile and we all became these really committed monotheists, and now we're going to rebuild Bayit Sheni. And now, at the moment that they're rebuilding Bayit Sheni, that's when this happens, all of a sudden they have this realization that we're actually in exactly the same position we were last time. And if we rebuild it, it's just going to get destroyed the day after. Because what destroyed the first one, a diamond in the rakez meganon, is still among us. And so they make a conscious decision to not, right, to give up something, to let Bayit Rishon be what everyone in Chazal and Raman and the Rishon predicted, Bayit Rishon becomes this pale shadow. Now, what is it that's wrong? What is it that Dayan Rakhid Dayan? So here, my thesis about Avodah Zarah, which is built largely off reading James Frazer's The Golden Bough, and which is this classic folklore anthology of Avodah Zarah, which I would say is probably wrong in every detail, and nonetheless the cumulative evidence is overwhelming. The picture of Judaism is just absurd, and scholarship tends to think that he had certain presuppositions that colored all the evidence he read. Nonetheless, he's just so much there, you know, that there's got to be something to it. And secondly, this becomes culturally important. The Torah for Avodah Zarah was really quite dead in the Western world until somewhere in the late 60s, I believe, a book was published by a science fiction author named Marion Zimmer Bradley called The Myth of Avalon, which is a retelling of the Arthur religion as the conquest of paganism and Christianity, with the sense that this is a bad idea. It's a defense of paganism. And so the neo-pagan movement in America traces from that book. Because that book is really good at recreating the Torah for Avodah Zarah. What my impression is from that book is that what paganism really means is the search for transcendence, the search for God, through peak physical experience. And peak physical experience, this gets a little more controversial, is achieved by the union of sex and violence. And so all pagan rituals are about the combination of sex and violence. Again, that's, you know, either it's really your experience or it's not, you know, or you think it's too psychologically to your meaning, whatever it may be. But they tend to be, you know, some kind of physical ordeal, followed by orgy. That tends to be what pagan rituals are. Now, what biblical religion is we domesticate sexuality. Right? It's still a sacrament, but it's only allowed in the house, and nothing like it is allowed anywhere in the temple, to the point that we invent underpants and ban ramps. Right? Two things are like, well, what is this doing? Like, who cares? Right? Well, but if you understand that, Avodah Zarah is about the union of the search for transcendence of sex and violence, so then we can explain why we have these absurd categories of tzniut in the Beit HaMikdash. And what the other thing that's wild about the Beit HaMikdash, and the Beit HaMikdash particularly, it can't be cut with iron, even when you're sacrificing, you're killing on it. So you can't build out of iron, right? Because you have to have a symbolic. You have to have a symbolic rejection, right? A sign that, right, that this, right, that violence, we're not going to take violence past this, even though we understand that human sacrifice is built, right, is a much bigger high of this, right? It's destroyed, it's a destructive urge, is what you're going for. So I think that one of the keys to all of Sefer Vayikra, and right, all notions of the Midrash, right, is that idea that the Judaism understands the power, but you know, you can't have all of the hallows together. You have to keep the three separate. Contained violence, you can have domesticated sexuality, you can't put the three of them together. But it tells you this, that if ecstasy, physical ecstasy, is your mode of worship, there's always going to be a danger that's just going to get out of control and become another zero. So it's at the moment that they're rebuilding by a chain, is what they're doing, they're dancing. And they see that Yitzhahara is dancing among them. Right? So it's a moment, right? It's a moment when they first start reconnecting physicality to religion. Right? When they let themselves be happy again. And all of a sudden they recognize that they're exactly the same as they were, and they make a choice that they're going to give up. Right? They're going to give up a certain amount of religious ecstasy because they can't figure out a way to be ecstatic without becoming pagan. Now, to me, this is what it's much, much discussed, but I want to wrap this up for Yeshivish framing. Mm-hmm. You know, become a schmooze. The first thing is it's an incredible thing to, at a moment of ecstasy, be capable of that kind of self-awareness. It is an incredible thing. Right, to be able to say in a moment when you could just lose yourself in the moment, right, and in the joy, and become another different Azara without even the faintest idea is happening to you. Right, it's an incredible thing to be able to be aware at that time. The parallel in Vakatsuka's reading of the Efkedah, the greatness of Avraham, is not that he was willing to sacrifice his work. The greatness of Avraham is that he has the capacity, right, he's in this incredible pagan religious moment, right, where he gets to combine sex and ultimate violence. It cuts to this really, dark vision of human nature. Like, everybody always wants to exercise their worst Yitzhahara. And it's at that moment that the Malach calls him, and he can just ignore the Malach and say, look, God told me, here goes the Malach. Right, it works for the moral, it works for the rabbis, right? They say, well, God told us, you're just a baskel, and that's how they get to, that's how they override the baskel. So why haven't they just said, well, you don't let God tell me directly, and just the moral, he doesn't. Because he still has that moment, he can wake up and say, whoa, this is wrong. I don't care how much I feel like this is, right? 30 seconds ago, I was sure that this was the moment when I was really going to be the ultimate religious figure because I was going to give the thing I most loved to God. I was going to be the greatest religious figure of all time. And then all of a sudden he said, no, this is wrong, and he can stop. And that's the Kafka's shot in why Al-Pishnaf is Hela Narvel Tatsu Milma. So that actually explains why the repetition, because Avraham says, couldn't I at least wound it? Right, which is weird, unless you think that Avraham really wanted to do it. Right, that's the Kafka's reading. So the first thing, it's just an incredible thing to be able to maintain self-awareness of self-judgment at moments of ecstasy. It's the kind of awareness, and then they make a choice. And the choice they make is to turn Judaism, right, they create religion Judaism. Right, they create a religion which is intellectual as opposed to physical, knowing full well the cost. It means that all around them, right, people are going to be having these ecstatic experiences they can only be jealous of. Now, maybe the rocket they get is that the Yitzhara gets killed to everybody until slowly paganism dies. Right, and so eventually, we don't have to worry about competing with the fires of Dolce. But in the short run, right, it's an incredible decision to be able to give up that capacity for the ecstasy and say, because we don't have the capacity to contain that ecstasy. There are two things about that I want to point out. Right? The first thing is the self-awareness. The second is the capacity to not then just despair. And we could have said, you know what, we can't build the Bayit we want, so what's the point of building anything? Right? Because what we get in Bayit Sheni is Ramban tells you it's just the shadow. Right? Bayit Sheni was never anything. Right? Ramban has an exegetical problem. The way he unreads Kumash, there should only be two Bayit Mikdash. And the second Beit Mikdash is supposed to be the ultimate doula, so what are we doing? So now the second one doesn't count. The second one is just play acting. And I think he has this Gemara in mind, and the Gemara tells you it's a choice. And they were misunderstanding themselves, so not to go for that. Now this thing has two nakedness, which are worth thinking about, two areas. One is, it seems to me like a really interesting framework for thinking about religious Zionism. Both because you have to, because there's a point in having something, even if you can't have what would be ideal, and two, because you always have to be aware, it didn't work last time. There's no inevitability, right? Here, people like to say around here, Darman says the third one's going to be the real one. Yeah, maybe the third one's not going to count either. Right, even if you were to hold, right, you know, even if you had the Ramban's vision of, you know, vision of history, right, nothing, right, you know, it's just utterly untrue to the text to think that because you think you're at some point in the process, therefore it must be inevitable. The second thing is this kind of sobriety, a sobriety about ecstasy, and an awareness that just as, you know, people usually use this to show that, look, every Yetzirah has a positive purpose, but it also teaches just as powerfully that even the most religious impulses are corruptible. And in particular, religious ecstasy is corruptible. So this tends to inform my skepticism about people who focus on spirituality as the primary value when organizing a religious community. And in particular, it says that some kind of, you know, that the goal, whether it be in dominant or culture as a whole, the goal is to have an ecstatic experience. If you can create an ecstatic experience, that's success. And anything short of that doesn't really matter. Right? What's the point of having davening as a fulfillment of the mitzvah if it doesn't give you high? And, you know, people who organize religion around physical, transcendent physical experiences. Now, I don't think we have anything like is there among the many of you who haven't read their Indian or Bradley? She probably shouldn't, I guess. I should tell you about it. Because it really makes it very attractive, it really does. You know, it's only because I assume I'm going to be on the entrance, but I have to. I can tell you what's out there. There's like a butcher. At least somebody has to be ready to be on the entrance. What happens if the Mashiach comes? And because there isn't anybody who knows about the Zara, and we can't recount the Sanhedrin, that would be terrible. So, I volunteer. Thank you. I expect your gratitude in this thing. I said, you know, well, yet again, here I am doing Aaron Cohen. You guys can just tell me the Shulara on those things. this is a good starting point for me in a lot of conversations about religion. Yeah. You should be aware of that, right? But that to me this Gemara teaches, you know, it's just a constant awareness that there are always costs. Right? That's like there are always benefits, there are always costs. And you always have to be aware that, you know, that even if it looks like you can't just be aware of the positive ends you're going to achieve, and sometimes it's legitimate, necessary to make choices and say, you know what, we're not going to try for this kind of ecstatic spirituality because we are aware of what that leads to, and we are not convinced ourselves of the way of containing that. Okay, those are messages I would encourage reflection on. In the 3 weeks, I don't have to end up with a maturing message. All right. Thank you again. Have a great Shabbat.